And our sermon text is Job chapter 2, verses 1 to 13. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. All that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand. Only spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came, each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. In the great American novel, The Red Badge of Courage, author Stephen Crane eloquently tells the story of a Union soldier in the American Civil War, Henry is all we know him by, who redeems himself from an act of cowardice by getting wounded in battle afterward. Henry flees the field of battle in abject fear, terror for his life early in the novel. He's haunted by shame in his own conscience, even though no one else is aware of his flight from the field. The Red Badge of Courage is an excellent example of the modern technique of inner dialogue, stream of consciousness in the American novel. Even though Henry's wound was random and fortuitous, through no particular act of bravery performed by himself, the feedback loop from other soldiers is enough to restore Henry's own self-image and his sense of worth. The bandage becomes his red badge of courage. What many readers don't realize is, and what struck me too as very powerful when I first read it, is that Henry is involved in an initial battle prior to the one in which he flees. Here he stands his ground with the rest of his comrades. As one professor of English puts it, although Henry battles his fear of the unknown during the first Confederate attack, he stands his ground with the rest of his comrades, celebrates this short initial victory. He's relieved to have withstood the pressure of his first taste of combat, and he holds fast, in part because of the rest of the men have done the same. It's during Henry's second battle that he turns coward and runs in utter panic and fear for his pathetic life. Gone is his initial pluck and bravado. All that remains is a beggarly yearning to save his own skin. Skin for skin, as Satan puts it. Job faces a second storm in our episode today. Job, too, has weathered storm one, an onslaught by the enemy of our souls, the accuser, the adversary, Satan. How will he respond to the second storm? like Henry in the Red Badge of Courage, or with integrity and covenantal faithfulness? Let's go to our text here and see how he does respond, shall we? You have in your inside flap of the bulletin there a place for some notes. This is our last sermon in the prologue before we launch out onto the sea of wisdom dialogue. So you must have the facts of the prologue clear in your mind if you're going to understand the rest of Job. Point number one of four, storm number two. The patriarchal lawsuit affords the judge opportunity to hold litigants accountable. The patriarchal lawsuit. And as we have asserted and demonstrated over the past few weeks in our initial descent into the book of Job, that the book of Job is structured like a patriarchal lawsuit. Very simply. And you have there an outline, a basic outline that has been distributed with your bulletin. There's been a lot of great research recently. By recently, I mean in the last century. When you look at scholarship, they talk in terms of decades and centuries as being recent, and millennia in terms of scholarship. So, and you have before you there just a very basic outline of the ancient patriarchal lawsuit. And as we're continuing to see, it explains a lot more about Job than the standard approaches. And so we, of course, are in under E here. We'll look at E and F here today. Opportunity for a second accusation, and the investigation continues. Well, we see that upon a day, then, a day, as it is put, which is a time marker, it tells us that in the narrative, some new things are going to obtain. Upon this day, the sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh. Now, as we've seen before, the sons of God, what are they? What does he mean here? Is Satan is considered a son of God? Is he a glorious being, a son of God like Christ or something like this? Well, what does the term son of God mean? The phrase the sons of God has a broad, comprehensive understanding of all those created beings formed directly by the hand of God. That's the sense of a son of God, because even Adam is designated a son of God, isn't he, in the genealogies, because he was created directly from the hand of God. We are creatures of God as well, but we have been created immediately through mothers and fathers. And so we are creatures, but nevertheless, we are not sons of God in the sense of having been created directly by the hand of God. If any of you think you may have, come and see me after the sermon, because we have some things to discuss. And these sons of God are myriad, glorious, powerful, of all kinds of ranks as well. When we are translated into glory, you think there's great and beautiful and marvelous and multifarious creatures here on this fallen earth. Wait till you get to heaven, and you will see in the new creation creatures that you will not be able to number. But we see in Scripture that the sons of God are of a variety of rank and feature and creation. There are angels of all rank, for example. Hebrews says he makes his messengers winds, his ministers a flaming fire, talking about angels. Paul asserts that the risen Christ is far above all rule and authority and power and dominion. Each one of those names, rule, authority, power, and dominion, are all used in incantations, for example, in Greek mythology. So Paul asserts that Christ is far above all angelic powers, all rule, authority, power, and dominion, and above every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the one to come. So sons of God are angels of all ranks. They're fallen angels of all rank as well. When men began to multiply, as Genesis 6 tells us, when man began to multiply in the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive. The sons of God there in Genesis chapter 6 are fallen angels. Then there are myriads of creatures, innumerable, uncountable. From Genesis to Revelation, we have descriptions of vast numbers of created beings. For example, Ezekiel chapter 1 tells us, "As I looked, behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, and a great cloud with brightness around it, and fire flashing forth continually, and in the midst of the fire, as it were, gleaming metal. And from the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures." Not angels per se, but four living creatures of other nature. So, sons of God, all the inhabitants of this invisible realm are consequently under the rubric of sons of God. They're not created without purpose either. Each has a place in the redemptive purpose of God, and each has a responsibility too, in accord with that purpose. Very important here. Each son of God has a responsibility and duty before God. All of these are sons of God insofar as they were created directly, immediately by the hand of God, and not through the mediary of the procreation of the creature. Each must therefore give a periodic accounting for their behavior. Each son of God must give a periodic accounting for their behavior. And this is what's happening before us. We've seen it earlier. This is deja vu all over again. But it gives me a second opportunity to drive home the importance of the prologue and the setting for the book of Job, because it explains a lot. The sons of God are not there for show. They are not appearing before God to strut their stuff for everybody else. The sons of God are not here today before us in chapter 2 for some kind of Alice in Wonderland tea party in their court finery. Every created being in the universe, as Paul puts it, will give an account of himself to God. And in fact, do you not know that we are to judge angels in that scenario? The majestic pageant of redemptive history. Job is also has great implications for the entire history of redemption during the patriarchal period. The majestic pageant of redemptive history is taking its course, and from time to time, every creature involved must account for his role and purpose and actions in it. This is what is encapsulated in that brief phrase, "The sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord." The idea of presenting oneself is giving an account of what you have been doing. Even as we saw in our parable a little earlier, right? The king calls his servants to account, to pay up debts and so forth. That's precisely the kind of thing that's going on here. The great king of heaven is calling his sons of God to account, to give account of themselves. Satan, as rebellious and contrary as he may be, is no exception. He's a creature serving the purpose of his creator. That's the sense in which he is a son of God. He too must give an account, as infernal and blasphemous as it may be. His accountability is implicit in God's inquiry. From where have you come? It's not friendly banter meant to ease the tension of the fall and rebellion. It's not just idle curiosity. God is not chilling today asking, "Hey dude, what's happening?" It's a demand. Account for your whereabouts and activity. So, Satan's compelled testimony, once again a reprise from chapter 1, from going to and fro on the earth, from walking up and down on it. Here, once more, God declares Job's moral integrity. Again, reprises this, and Job's covenantal faithfulness, doesn't he? Have you considered my servant Job? Now, remember, this is not idle banter either. This goes to stand throughout the book of Job. If Satan can tempt him to fall, tempt him to even deny his covenantal integrity and faithfulness, Satan will have won. Because God goes out on a limb, if we can put it that way, right? By saying, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man. Blameless and upright doesn't mean entirely sinless or void of the nature of Adam, a special created nature. No, what he means here by blameless and upright is that he is a man of moral integrity and covenantal faithfulness. That's the sense in which Job is blameless and upright. Covenantally faithful. When he does sin, he makes sacrifice for it. Blameless, that is, he is a man of moral integrity, doing the right thing. Also a man who fears God and turns away from evil. So when Satan says, does Job fear God for naught? That's the summary of Job's character and integrity, the idea of fearing God. And God goes on to say, he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. Now in Hebrew, the same phrase is used by Satan. Does Job fear God without reason? So God is turning the tables on him here and says, you say, does Job fear God for no reason? You incited me for no reason. And so, in God's declaration here, his reaffirmation of Job's integrity, what is also at stake, keep this in mind, it's one of the six interpretive principles of Job that we've established. What is also at stake in God's word and understanding of the progress of redemptive history, does God get it wrong? Does God get it wrong? Is he wrong here? Will the text demonstrate, will the rest of Job demonstrate that perhaps God is wrong? That is one of the things at stake. If Job denies his own integrity and his own covenantal faithfulness, that is being a blameless and upright man, then he belies God himself, who has declared him to be so. This really helps clear up one of the nagging, persistent questions I had as I came to Job prior to preparing to preach the book of Job. We're all sinners. Why doesn't Job just belly up to the bar, as his friends suggest, and say, all right, okay, I'm a sinner. Perhaps there's something in my past. Perhaps there's something I've overlooked. And all right, I'm not blameless and a man of covenantal integrity. Okay, so what's the big deal? Let's get on with it, okay? Why doesn't Job just do that? Many of us would be tempted to do precisely that thing. If he does, he denies God's word and God's own understanding of him. And so, consequently, there are two defendants in this patriarchal lawsuit, Job and God. God's word is at stake. God's integrity, God's understanding and knowledge of his creature, his progress in redemption is indeed at stake here as well. And so Job becomes God's champion after a fashion too in this trial by ordeal, because that's how the issue of the patriarchal lawsuit is determined, through a trial by ordeal, a trial by combat. There are also consequences for redemptive history. Will God be able to raise up a new Adam as history progresses, as redemption progresses? Will God be able to raise up a new Adam to crush the head of the serpent, as he covenantally promised in the covenant of redemption back in Genesis 3:15? Where indeed the seed of the serpent will crush his heel, but he will crush your head. Will God be able to raise up a new Adam to crush the head of the serpent? Is redemption progressing through history? Is Job a point along that way? Does Job indeed demonstrate that redemption is progressing? All these things are at stake. So there are layers of complexity, but they're not ununderstandable, are they? They are perfectly understandable if you apply your mind to them. And you will understand the book of Job with greater clarity as we move through it. We have sermons on the earlier chapter as well as an introduction, where I inculcate all these things. I understand repetition is the soul of learning. So if you've heard this before, please be patient with me. Because repetition will help ingrain it in you. If this is all brand new to you, please consult the earlier sermons. I understand they will be up on the website. And you must understand the prologue if you will understand. Otherwise, it will just be a mass of confusion to you. All right. Point number two then. Storm number two. The patriarchal lawsuit. That's the structure. That's the form of the book of Job. The patriarchal lawsuit affords the prosecution a second opportunity to accuse. Verses 4 and 5. One of the very persuasive elements in establishing that the patriarchal lawsuit is indeed the form of the book of Job. You see that's under E, under your outline. There is an opportunity in the ancient patriarchal lawsuit for a second accusation. As you observe, the patriarchal lawsuit provides for the prosecution now to bring additional indictments when it's warranted, especially if initial ones fail of their objective. And our outline follows this pattern exactly. It's an important feature of the patriarchal lawsuit. It's preserved in hundreds of records found now in the Mari and the Nuzi tablets. They were discovered in the early 20th century. There's hundreds of them. They've been spending a century translating all these clay tablets, cuneiform writing. Well, Satan's declaration is considered to be a formal indictment in this structure. Skin for skin, he says. All that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. The second accusation. As if Satan's first indictment was not cynical enough, this one adds personal injury to insult, doesn't it? Once more, Job does not fear God for naught, Satan asserts, because God protects and preserves his person and his health. In the end, it's the ultimate sense of that selfish sense of the existential relief, the self-preservation instinct that at least it's not me, whatever happens to somebody else. At least it's not me, what I call the Hezekiah syndrome. Remember Hezekiah? What he said in response to a prophecy? Hezekiah boasts, he gets some envoys from Babylon. He shows them all the glories of Israel that had been acquired, accumulated, built up under Solomon. How glorious Israel was. And Isaiah says, you fool. The word of the Lord that you have, I'm sorry. And Isaiah says that Babylon, because of what he's just done, would someday invade and destroy Judah. How does Hezekiah respond as he tears robes and put dust on his head? He says, the word of the Lord that you have spoken is good. For he thought, why not? If there will be peace and security in my days. It's not me, right? The Hezekiah syndrome. When Henry, in the red badge of courage, sees a friend cut down in battle, he clings to his own breast, thinking, at least it's not me. When something bad happens to somebody else, a first tendency is to think, that's terrible, but at least it's not me, right? Satan accuses. As Job loses his animals, and then his servants, and yea, even his children, Satan says, he's secretly saying in his heart, God, at least it's not me, or skin for skin. That's what that euphemism in Hebrew is referring to. At least if not me. Cynical. Satan asserts that by touching his person, you will uncover his hatred for you. He will curse you to your face in doing so. Job will finally be revealed to be no different than his fallen first father, Adam. He'll be of my seed, Satan is asserting. Not that of the one who will crush my head. Your progress of redemption, Yahweh, will be in shambles. Your word will be proven void that you've just asserted about your servant Job. You'll be shown to be not covenantally faithful, not a man of moral integrity, but a liar like me. And also, it will be shown that your knowledge of him is limited. The knowledge of your creature is limited. And in this case, in error, because you've asserted just the opposite. You see what's at stake? You see why anywhere along the line, if Job denies his integrity, his covenantal faithfulness, his righteousness, which may seem like hubris to us, he will have lost the case. He will have lost as a champion of God. There's much more than just a debate about why the righteous suffer, or just a term paper on Western philosophical questions of theodicy, like why is there evil? Some of you guys in Bible school may write papers on why is there evil, and Job will be. Doesn't mean that Job doesn't speak to it. Indeed, he does. Indeed, he does speak to why do the righteous suffer. But that's not the driving and main question, is it? What is the driving and main question of Job? Doth Job fear God for naught? That is the driving question. That's what starts all the action of Job and is at heart and soul of the book of Job. Does Job serve God for naught? I.e., not for stuff, you know, by being a good man. By being a righteous man, well, God lavishes you with possessions and family and good health, right? What's at the heart of the health and wealth gospel, as it's distorted, as that principle is distorted. Doth Job serve God for naught? And that Satan way of putting for faith, for love, just because God is. Do you love God just for who he is and what he is, just because he is? Do you serve him? Do you fear him just because of that? It shows that you know him if you do. And Satan says he does not. So you see, what is at stake? And so then, for a second time, God declares game on. The court is now in session. Behold, that's the sense of the behold there. In other words, let's inaugurate the case. He is in your hand. Only spare his life. That one condition. Only spare his life. We see Satan is a limited and finite creature too. He's not God's equal in any way, shape, or form. And that brings us to point three. Storm number two. Storm number two. The patriarchal lawsuit, that's the form of the book of Job, the way in which it operates, the working mechanism of Job is the patriarchal lawsuit. The patriarchal lawsuit affords further trial by ordeal in order to resolve the question, verses 6 through 8. We determine verdict by evidence. The ancient world, especially in the patriarchal period, often resolved verdicts in other fashion. Which of two contestants were in the right and bore God's favor was often decided in the ancient world by trial by ordeal. Trial by ordeal. Especially when the evidence per se was ambiguous. By subjecting one or more of the subjects in the trial to various elements, a decision could be reached, a verdict could be reached. There were three main trial by ordeals. I know some of the kids know this better than some of the adults because we've gone over and over ad nauseum oftentimes, right? In Sunday school class. The three trials were trial by fire. Men tested by fire. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Exhibit A, right? How did they come through? Was God's favor on them? More so than the poor guys who had to throw them in there who got toasted, right? There's trial by water, Noah and his family. The most luminous here. God's favor was on Noah and his family, preserving them, everybody else, blub, blub, blub. Then there's trial by combat, which is the trial by ordeal we're seeing play out here. Trial by combat, David and Goliath being exhibit A there. So we've gone through this in greater detail earlier in the series. But we're apprising it for those that have heard it before. Maybe it's brand new for others of you. Go back to those earlier sermons. Job is in a trial by combat. But it's more complex than that because he's in combat with both Satan as prosecutor and God. There's a sense in which he is a champion of God, but he's also in combat with God as the ultimate sovereign over the whole situation. Job realizes this. In fact, Job's main beef will be with God. He immediately recognizes God as the one who purposes all things. And for the life of him, Job can't fathom why God is doing these things to him. That'll be a constant motif. Why do the righteous suffer? So we will be able to address some of those questions. It's just not the one that drives the book of Job. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores. It's a sense of repugnance to all who saw him or smelled those things. Job will talk about these things in greater detail in the body of Job, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Now, the nature of this disease has been oft debated, everything from leprosy to bubonic plague, or perhaps elephantiasis. Third world has more of this than we do. And we'll see elephantiasis has other symptoms too, such as a loss of appetite. So that's my... But it's not important enough to be a hill to die on. Suffice it to say that Job was in great pain and discomfort. I was reminded of Job visiting Olga before she passed. She suffered greatly in her latter days from bed sores. Often winced in pain. Imagine those from head to foot. And so Job's fall from riches to rags is succinctly and poignantly described in his attempt at relief, too. He took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. What a pathetic scene. Scraping opened the sores to some measure of draining and diminishment. Dust and ash applied to cover exposure to air and thus diminish the pain. Additionally, the ash heap in patriarchal culture was outside the city where garbage was dumped. It was the Gehenna, the metaphor for hell of the ancient world. Job could not have sunk any lower without dying. And as we shall see, Satan might not have taken his life, but he made sure that he took Job to the very last extremity, such that Job will wish that God had taken his life. But Job's suffering is not merely physical. That brings us to point four. The patriarchal lawsuit. Patriarchal lawsuit is on, and it will be decided by a trial by ordeal. This is the form of Job. These are the things that are driving the dialogues. These are the things that are behind the entire book of Job. All that we've unfolded for you here in the prologue is the backdrop. Keep the backdrop in mind because it's ever present throughout the book of Job. We'll get lost in the weeds and the dialogues, but behind the dialogues, and intently watching over the battlements of heaven are all the sons of God, God himself, and Satan as prosecutor. That is the backdrop. That is the scene in which Job takes place. And you've seen the stakes, too, for the book of Job, for what Job is transpiring in Job's life. So you have then the patriarchal lawsuit in 4. Patriarchal lawsuit also affords witnesses for the prosecution to test the accused. You have that there in your outline, too. That's in F and G. Taking of additional evidence by corroborating witnesses. What of the witnesses? We see Job's wife, his three friends. With friends like these, though, who needs enemies, right? That Western cliche is a persistent motif throughout Job. You can almost hear him saying, with friends like these, who needs enemies? Well, surely the wife of his bosom will comfort him, his turtle dove, his soulmate, the one who bakes his bread and bore his children, right? Unfortunately, she becomes a witness for the prosecution too, doesn't she? Tempting Job to do precisely as Satan had predicted, the very words that will lose the case for Job and for God, consequently. Do you still hold fast your integrity? The very thing God has testified is true of Job, a man of integrity. And she says, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. You see the consequences for cursing God, right, from our reading from the law today? Curse God and die. Case closed. If he'd done this, case closed. We can go on to the book of Revelation or something. Most men would buckle under this pressure if the previous storms had not already caused him to. If it had been Mrs. Job at trial, or if Job had followed her advice, the trial would be over, the verdict declared in the prosecution's favor. Both Job and God would be guilty as charged. Game over. Seed of the serpent would be triumphant. The seed of the serpent would be triumphant. You see the issues at stake, I hope, when you consider the stretch of the patriarchal period from Noah to Abraham, hundreds of years, perhaps millennia. This is progress in redemption, or not. These are the things at stake in the book of Job. But the champion of God does not buckle, does he? You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? This is true fear of God, isn't it? Isn't it? When you read this in its context and with everything that is at stake, this is a beautiful statement that should bring you to tears. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? Covenantally faithful to the core he is. And the gracious way in which he speaks to her, too. You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. That is a very gracious thing in the face of the temptation here. She knows better. Up to this point, she was possessed of better wisdom, but now she errs, speaking as one of the foolish. As one commentator puts it, this is frailty, not folly. Hers was a momentary lapse of judgment. Frailty, not folly, not foolishness. There is also an indicator that Job yet fears God for naught. That is, he's willing to receive both good and evil from God's hand and still trust God and be God's servant. This is a beautiful confession of faith. Well, okay, so far so good. But what about those who speak like foolish men? They're still to come. And now we begin what is the real nut of wisdom literature here, too. The arrival of Job's three friends. text tells us, each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. Get used to these cats. They inhabit the rest of the book. They also inhabited lands that were renowned in the ancient world for wisdom, too. So the book is gathering some strings together now. In fact, some have discerned patterns of wisdom in their speeches that represent various schools of wisdom, meant to test Job and the pathetic situation into which he'd fallen. These three friends, cohorts with Job the Uzite, they were colleagues in wisdom. They were the very pinnacle of wisdom in the day. They were the best and the brightest. If these guys can't figure it out, then no one can. Having studied and debated and encouraged one another over the years in these matters, they're shocked when they actually get there. Approaching the ash heap, qua dump, they couldn't recognize him even. Gone was the sleek, well-fed, wise man who enjoyed all the blessings that a life of fearing God could afford, health and wealth and family, all to an abundant measure. Instead, here was an abandoned worm of a man, as Job will call himself. An abandoned worm of a man. Bereft of all that he'd had before, for all intents and purposes, one step from the grave. You use that phrase as well. And their response is one of empathy, too. They perform a traditional funeral ritual, weeping, tearing the robe, sprinkling dust on the head. From dust we've come, to dust we shall return. And the formality of sitting silently with the family of the deceased is called sitting Shiva, which is seven, the number seven. It is a traditional mode of mourning with the family of the deceased. All right, perhaps we finally got the crew that it will take to nurture Job in his fear of God for naught. We finally got the team that's going to do that? We'll see. They will apply every particle of wisdom they have accumulated over the years to the solution of what God is doing with Job. And what Job must do to please God and find his favor once more. And in the course of doing so, we'll see paraded before us the accumulated wisdom of the patriarchal period. That's part of what Job does. It's kind of a digest of wisdom of the patriarchal age before Sinai, right? There's no glib appeals to the law of God here, as the Pharisees might have done. And the vehicle of the patriarchal lawsuit thus becomes the Cadillac instrument, if you will, of showing off the accumulated wisdom of the day. One reason the book of Job is so long. But even then, it's a digest of the wisdom of the patriarchal period. But will it be enough? Will it be enough to answer our questions? One of the challenges and one of the answers we'll come to may be surprising to you. Will they discern with all this wisdom the purpose of Job's suffering? Or will they be like the wise ones of Jesus' day who exclaimed, "He trusts in God, let God deliver him now if he desires him, for he said, I am the Son of God." They all thought they knew why the Christ was suffering. But there are purposes for suffering, the reasons for which the sufferer and those around him do not know. That is one of the six interpretive principles of the book of Job. There are purposes for suffering, and they are here, are they not? We know the purposes for Job's suffering. Does Job ever know the purposes of his suffering? He does not. Does he? Never knows. Not even in the concluding vignette of the book of Job. Those around him certainly don't know why he's suffering. do they? They get it all wrong. There are purposes for suffering, the reasons for which the sufferer does not know, and those around him do not know. We'll look at the life of Elie Wiesel, who is Exhibit A in this as well. Those of Jesus' day did not know our Lord as sovereign and as all-knowing, knew the purposes for his suffering, but those around him certainly did not at the time of his suffering, did they? This is that bridge between Job and Christ. This principle is full of truth and compassion, that there are reasons for suffering that the sufferer and those around him do not know. And you can bring comfort to a sufferer who may not know why he is suffering. The book of Job does that, even as the life of Christ does that as well. So we can apply the book of Job to those who are suffering around us, or maybe to our own lives as well. With this in mind, let us now come to that place then of truth and compassion that is wrapped up in the simple elements of Jesus' body and blood, as we find it in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.